Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Current Perspectives on Cancer Survivorship. This activity is supported by the Anna Fuller Fund and an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo, and I really want to thank them for the support of today's program. To start, I just want to let you know how many people we have on the call today. We have over 360 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom, so it is a global call. We are delighted to have you all on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Paulos, and Dr. Paulos is former Clinical Protocol Administration Manager, Office of Cancer Survivorship, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, author and researcher in caregiving, healthcare disparities, and survivorship. Dr. Paulos will be discussing finding your new normal and the importance of treatment summaries and encounter notes. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my colleague, Dr. Paulos.
Thank you, Ms. Nazarian, for inviting me to join this distinguished panel and audience. Today, we will focus on an important topic, cancer survivorship and what it means to you as a patient, survivor, or long-term warrior of this disease. Throughout today's teleconference, my esteemed colleagues will also share information that can help you and your loved ones navigate the ups and downs of this unpredictable roller coaster experience. I'd like to begin with a question for our callers. What does finding a new normal mean to you as a patient? What does it mean to your family and to your caregivers? If each of you were allowed to share your thoughts on this call, we'd see that the meaning of this phrase varies from person to person. There may be expectations to return to doing things as you did before. Loved ones, friends, colleagues, and even pets want life to go back to what they knew or go back to normal times, that is, before the cancer. Yet these expectations often may be unrealistic. Why? Well, there are several adjustments that may be necessary in the physical, emotional, financial, and other critical areas of one's life. And I'm sure many of you on this call already have experienced that or are going through that or have watched your loved ones go through that. In addition to making these types of adjustments, you may find yourself having worries about recurrence, concerns over unexpected symptoms, and trying to figure out how to find your new identity. It may take a bit to determine what are your new activities, what are your new roles, and what kind of expectations can you, your family, and friends, and even colleagues now face. The road ahead may not be the one you imagined, but there are several tools to support you and your family along the way. For instance, you can focus on building a strong support network. You can explore services that can help with mental health concerns, such as lingering sadness or survivor's guilt. And you can seek resources for career and financial needs. As a cancer survivor, a patient may find their appointments are less frequent and may not have the same team of providers as before. Patients have told me they often feel lost in transition, and that's when patients find themselves facing this new normal, which can be overwhelming. The journey may look different than you expected, but again, there are resources to support you. There are two tools that can keep you current and informed of your progress. You may have discovered the usefulness of encounter notes or summaries of visits with your team as a patient. It would be beneficial to continue checking those notes even after the treatment has ended. Using your MyChart abilities, is an informed method to keep up and updated with your health and to communicate with your providers. And one of our speakers will also speak later on about the benefits of teleconferencing. For those moving into extended survivorship with routine follow-up, a cancer survivorship care plan or treatment summary can be invaluable. A survivorship care plan is a roadmap tailored to the needs, long-term side effects, and specific treatments of each person. The plan outlines ways to live a healthier lifestyle, including how to achieve a better nutrition or exercise. It also provides a structure on how to follow screening procedures such as mammograms or colonoscopies, another important test. And the care plan provides a blueprint to manage long-term side effects such as fatigue, interrupted sleep, or anxiety. In short, a survivorship care plan can support the goal of achieving an optimal quality of life. While you adjust to your normal, take time to recognize that although you, your body, and your life have changed, you still function. You are still here, and you've retained your resilience, self-identity, values, and inner strength. So I leave you with this closing question. What lessons have you learned along your experience? And how can those experiences foster hope for you and your loved ones as you navigate the future as a cancer survivor? My fellow panelists will cover many of these topics today. I thank you for your attention. And Ms. Rosario, I'll now return the program back to you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pello. It's just a wonderful presentation. Covered a lot of information. It was engaging. Thank you so much again. And now I'm going to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira, and Dr. Shapira is Professor of Medicine Oncology, Stanford University School of Medicine, Director, Cancer Survivorship Program, Stanford Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Shapira will be discussing an overview of cancer survivorship, managing post-treatment side effects / late effects, and quality of life concerns. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Shapira.
And thank you so much for the opportunity. And as everybody is reflecting on what survivorship means to them, as my colleague, Dr. Palos, just encouraged us to do, let me tell you a little bit about survivorship and understand what we mean about survivorship care. Today, more people than ever are living longer after a cancer diagnosis. In the U.S., we have more than 18 million, closer to 18.5 million people living with a history of cancer. 70% of these survivors have lived 5 or more years since their diagnosis. 49% have lived 10 or more years since their diagnosis, and 22% of those more than 20 years. So this growing population has led to an important shift in how we think about cancer care. It's no longer enough to focus only on treating the disease. We have to focus on how people live after cancer, and this is the field we now call cancer survivorship. We define a cancer survivor as anyone from the moment of diagnosis through the rest of their life. But today, I'll talk briefly about three important aspects of survivorship. The first is what cancer survivorship actually means. Second, how survivors manage the side effects and late effects of treatment. And third, how we support quality of life after cancer. So first, cancer survivorship, as we said, begins at diagnosis and continues for the rest of a person's life. For many people, completing treatment is a moment of celebration and relief, but it's also the beginning of a new phase of care, and many survivors often continue to need medical follow-up and support and specialized care for many years. So survivorship care focuses on several goals. First, it includes monitoring for recurrence, meaning a careful follow-up to detect whether the cancer might return or progress for those living with cancer. Second, it involves screening for new cancers, since some survivors may be at higher risk for developing another cancer later in life, either as a result of an exposure to cancer treatment or perhaps due to an inherited genetic risk. Third, survivorship care focuses on managing the lasting effects of cancer treatment. Fourth, it aims to support the emotional, social, and practical needs, even financial needs of survivors and their families. And finally, survivorship care emphasizes coordination between specialists and primary care clinicians, as many cancer survivors need more than one group of clinicians to meet all of their needs throughout their lifespan. So coordinating care remains a challenge in our fragmented healthcare system. And one tool that is used in survivorship care is a survivorship care plan. This is a document that summarizes the treatment a patient has received and outlines recommended follow-up care, health screenings, and healthy lifestyle strategies. And you'll be hearing more about this. Many people assume that when cancer treatment ends, life quickly returns to normal, but most survivors will tell you that that just doesn't ring true. For many, recovery can take time, and what lies ahead may look quite different from their pre-cancer life, and that is what we all have agreed to call the new normal. Cancer treatments can leave lasting effects on the body. These effects are generally grouped into two categories: short-term side effects and late effects. So in medicine, we call the short-term side effects those that occur during cancer treatment or shortly after. And typical examples are fatigue, nausea, pain, neuropathy, hair loss. Many of these just improve with time. But late effects are different. These are health problems that may appear months or even years after treatment has ended. For example, some chemotherapy drugs can affect heart health. Radiation therapy may increase the risk of other medical problems in the radiation field. Some people may have hormonal changes related to early menopause or infertility or sexual health issues that persist. Because of these possibilities, specialized long-term survivorship care is often essential. Survivorship care often involves a team approach and involves, of course, the primary care clinician, the oncologist, but also others, physical therapists, perhaps occupational therapists, rehabilitation specialists, mental health specialists. Survivors themselves also play an important role in protecting their health. Healthy lifestyle choices can significantly improve recovery and long-term well-being, and some key behaviors we recommend are maintaining regular physical activity, eating a balanced and nutritious diet, avoiding tobacco, getting enough sleep, managing body weight, and keeping up with recommended health screenings. These behaviors and actions can help reduce the risk of future health problems and improve overall well-being. So finally, let's talk a little bit about quality of life after cancer. Cancer affects much more than the body. It can influence emotional health, relationship, work, finances, and even personal identity. Many survivors experience a period of emotional adjustment after treatment ends. During treatment, you may have frequent appointments and a clear plan and feel supported, but when treatment stops, many people feel a sense of uncertainty and the anxiety bubbles up. A common concern is fear of recurrence, and we're going to be talking a little bit more about that. Emotional support can make a huge difference. Counseling, survivorship programs, peer support can help survivors process the experiences, reflect on their experience, and regain a sense of control. Cancer can also affect family relationships and social roles. Survivors may face challenges returning to work or managing responsibilities in home, and roles may have shifted within a family during the time of cancer treatment. These realities remind us that survivorship care must address the whole person, not just the disease. And today, many cancer centers and community practices offer survivorship services that distinctly target all of these issues that we have just addressed. And increasingly, they also incorporate digital tools and peer support networks. So in conclusion, cancer survivorship represents one of the greatest successes of modern medicine. Because of advances in treatment, millions of people now live many years, decades after cancer diagnosis. But survival alone is not the final goal. The next challenge is to make sure that survivors receive the support they need to recover, adapt, and thrive. So thank you so much for allowing me to participate in the call. I'll turn it over back to you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shapiro. That was just an excellent presentation. You covered a lot of information in a short amount of time, so I'm sure that there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you again. And our next speaker is Dr. Jay Ross, and Dr. Ross is Assistant Attending Psychologist, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Assistant Professor of Psychology and Clinical Psychiatry, Weill Cornell Graduate School of Medical Sciences. And Dr. Ross will be discussing fear of recurrence. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ross.
Hey, thank you so much, Johnny, and thank you for inviting me to be here this afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. Wherever you're listening from this afternoon, whether you're a survivor, a caregiver, or someone who loves a cancer survivor, I'm really glad you joined us today. As Dr. Paulos and Dr. Shapiro have pointed out, if cancer has touched your life, even in the past, it likely changed something about how the future feels. Even when treatment ends, even when scans are clear, many people notice something that lingers, a watchfulness, a sensitivity, and often a quiet question that begins with two words, what if? What if it's back? What if this pain means something? What if the scan shows bad news? And if these thoughts sound familiar, you're not unusual. They're a human response to living with uncertainty after cancer. And today I want to talk about what we do with those two words, what if. When we begin to look closely at the thoughts that follow those words, we often notice two familiar patterns, and I found it helpful to give those patterns name. I like to call them protective Paula and catastrophic Kathy. So protective Paula says, let's pay attention. Let's go to follow-up. That's new. Let's monitor it. Catastrophic Kathy shows up too with, what if the cancer's back? What if they miss something? What if this time it's worse? What if you can't survive it again? Both are trying to protect you, and they protect you in very different ways. Paula leans towards management, and Kathy leans towards catastrophe. And when uncertainty increases, one of them usually gets a lot louder. Now, for many people, and you might have experienced this, that happens the days leading up to a scan. We call it scanxiety. Kathy starts whispering, oh, this is the one you already know. Start preparing. You notice your anxiety rise. Your sleep gets lighter. The mind begins rehearsing worst-case scenarios. Kathy's strategy is anticipation. If you expect the worst, maybe you won't be blindsided. But anticipating the worst rarely reduces uncertainty. It just makes us suffer in advance. And it's not only scans that will bring her out. Sometimes she shows up in the quietest moments. I worked with a survivor who told me that bedtime had become the hardest part of her day. During the day, she was steady. She was busy with work. She had friends and the ordinary rhythm of life. But when the lights went off and the room got quiet, Kathy showed up. What if it's back? What if that ache meant something? Oh, Kathy wouldn't let her fall asleep. And then protective Paula would join in, suggesting she check one more time, look something up, mentally review the last appointment. My patient described it as feeling responsible, like staying mentally vigilant was part of surviving. What eventually helped wasn't trying to resolve Kathy and Paula's concerns right then. It was learning to pause and say, hey, this is bedtime, ladies. Chillax. There's no urgency to solve this right now. Not because the fear wasn't real, but because nighttime wasn't the moment to decide the future. And for many people, once the scan is over, the fear doesn't disappear. It just shifts. It becomes the space between appointments. You might recognize this one. What if something's happening right now and we don't know? But here's an important thing to remember. Follow-up schedules with your providers are designed with one goal, to catch recurrence early, when it's more like a smoldering ember before it becomes a three-alarm fire. So granted, early detection doesn't guarantee control, but it does mean there is a system watching with you. Monitoring is shared. You are not solely responsible for catching every sign. And sharing that responsibility matters because it means you don't have to carry the entire burden of vigilance by yourself. Part of survivorship is learning to trust that shared system of watching. But our minds don't always remember that, and sometimes Protective Paula begins working overtime. So she'll jump in and say, hey, let's Google this, let's read more, let's double check. And first, that feels responsible. But the goal will quietly shift from staying informed to trying to eliminate uncertainty altogether. At its core, both catastrophe and overcontrol are attempts to regain certainty. And part of survivorship is learning that both certainty and uncertainty are part of life and finding ways to live alongside the uncertainty. Now, this is where a small but really powerful question can help. When a what if appears, you might gently ask yourself, who's talking right now? Is this Kathy escalating possibility into certainty? Is this Paula offering proportion? Or has Paula drifted into overdrive? And that question creates space. Space between the what if and your next move. And in that space, you get to choose proportion. So as I wrap this up today, I just want to leave you with something important to remember. Having what if thoughts and that fear of recurrence, that doesn't mean you're failing at survivorship. It means your mind is trying to protect something that matters. And you don't have to silence those thoughts. You don't have to answer them. You don't have to defeat uncertainty. But you can notice when fear is escalating, and you can notice when control is overreaching, and you can gently return to what is actually within your influence. Survivorship isn't about eliminating what if or gaining complete control. It's about restoring proportion so that what matters speaks louder than the uncertainty. And you can keep returning to the life and the people you've worked so hard to keep. Again, thank you for letting me come here today and talk to you a little bit about this fear of recurrence. And I want to thank each of you for showing up today and for the care and the intentions that you bring to trying to live well after cancer. And with that, I'll turn it back to Johnny.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ross. It's, again, another incredible and insightful presentation today. Thank you so much again. And now our next speaker is Dr. Jed Seltzer. And Dr. Seltzer is clinical psychologist, psychosocial coordinator, oncology service, the VA New Jersey Healthcare. And Dr. Seltzer will be discussing survivor's guilt. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Seltzer.
Hi, thank you very much. I appreciate you inviting me, and it's an honor to be part of this panel. So as Johnny mentioned, I'm going to be discussing survivor's guilt among cancer survivors. But first, I want to address the concept of guilt in general, because it's actually a useful concept, not just an important concept. And I want to emphasize that today, how actually useful it can be. So psychoanalyst and researcher Joseph Weiss in the 1980s postulated that while guilt is sometimes a result of having intentionally harmed or hoped to harm another, more often an individual feels it because they're suffering from an irrational fear of potentially hurting or having hurt others, caused simply by the attempt to further their own cause. He proposed it was actually a derivative of altruism, part of our genuine desire to give to others, sometimes perhaps at our own expense. So the question remains, if it is irrational for survivors to think that they've hurt others just by surviving, is this a form of magical thinking? And if so, why do we even do it if it hurts? That's what we'll get to today. And because it seems irrational and because it hurts, we often see guilt as a bad word, a feeling that we have to purge, including among friends or family who we don't want to see suffer and who we would want to be compassionate with themselves. I find self-compassion to be a very important tool in psychotherapy in my practice, but before we get to self-compassion with an individual, it might be helpful or even necessary to move through the guilt, to recognize what it is telling us, what its function is. Because after all, guilt is an indicator that something is amiss emotionally. It's like akin to bodily pain. It's telling us something. So survivor's guilt in particular was most voluminously documented regarding the Holocaust. Researchers dubbed an entire new mindset as survivor syndrome. And it could be debilitating. It involved maintaining persistent guilt and a fear of being punished for having lived while other ones perished. So there's this arbitrary quality to life that emerges to who lives and who dies. During the AIDS crisis, it was widely documented. There were widely documented feelings of survivor's guilt, especially the why not me sentiment, which you often hear among cancer survivors as well, which is associated with difficulty truly recognizing and communicating emotional distress. In the AIDS crisis, survivor's guilt was found to have served as a mediator of depression among this population. Among cancer survivors, it sometimes arises after survivors have made strong connections with other survivors in healthcare settings or in support groups and other such venues. Camaraderie in support groups and connections made in clinical context is wonderful and enriching, but it can be a double-edged sword and it can, of course, lead to grief for those lost. So I would advise you all, if you are so inclined to participate in support groups or if you already participate in one, to be mindful of that and to refer to the counselor or psychotherapist who's leading the group to help manage the group in ways where these themes are discussed and managed. Survivor's guilt is widespread among cancer patients. In one study by Perloff and colleagues in 2019, they found some 55% of lung cancer patients endorsed having survivor's guilt. So the question remains, is it, and the question is, that is rife in the literature about survivor's guilt, is it pathological or is it normative? In other words, is it something that is quote unquote wrong and needs to be purged, or is it something that is normal? Actually, the criteria for PTSD in the DSM, our Handbook for Mental Health Disorders, used to include survivor's guilt, and now it doesn't. So that shows you how much there is debate about this. But I think that regardless of whether we think it's indicative of something quote-unquote wrong or whether we think it's normal, it's worth recognizing and working through, not just hand-waving it away as survivors being too hard on themselves. So why is it worth recognizing and working through? Because it serves certain functions. Survivor's guilt is a way of coping and making sense of what appears to be an unfair, arbitrary, and out-of-control situation. It's a way of actually holding on to grief. Guilt can invalidate or mitigate the feelings of loss and provide emotional distance, but it still helps the individual stay close to the lost loved one in this kind of arm's length kind of way. And it actually creates a vulnerability in relation to survivor solidarity with others who died of the same disease. It's also worth discussing with a therapist because it can be debilitating. It leads to psychic numbing or the cessation of feeling, which can be a dominating lifestyle characteristic experienced by those who suffered feelings of death guilt. We often think of this as akin to the term anhedonia, the absence of genuine emotional feeling. Again, though, it's understandable because this may be protective, right? So it serves a protective function to distance oneself from one's raw or true feelings. So survivor's guilt ultimately serves as a defense against a sense of powerlessness and helplessness in the face of loss, trauma, and one's own mortality. And cancer challenges our learned sense of fairness and justice. Cancer challenges the quote-unquote healthy denial of death that we all maintain. It makes us more vulnerable, and it damages our sense of control. So survivor's guilt helps us reestablish that healthy denial, in a way, that arm's length that we maintain in order to continue to function as individuals in the shadow of death, right? So survivor's guilt causes us to reexamine our schemas, all of our ways of thinking about the world and ourselves. So it serves important purposes. But if we can get to the feelings underneath, if we can engage in emotion identification, emotions that led to the guilt, then we can turn it around and move forward productively. What are we defending or distancing ourselves from? Is it grief? Is it loss? Or is it unease about the world and the way it works or other similar sentiments? And ultimately, survivor's guilt can create an existential crisis that actually creates an opportunity for a productive response, as Dr. Paulus and others mentioned. Why am I here? Why did I remain? These questions are daunting, but they're opportunities. And ultimately, they can lead to engaging in a life of purpose, re-engaging in a life of purpose, following one's values, not as a means of lessening the guilt, but as a way of harnessing its underlying feelings to shift focus to what matters and to even create a sense of urgency in doing so. And before I wrap up, I want to note that cancer caregivers, as we all know, can often experience a whole other but related set of survivor's guilt that they don't have time to talk about today. But for those of you on the call who are cancer caregivers, please know what a wonderful and special job you're doing and you're performing. Okay, thanks very much for your time and attention. Back to you, Johnny.
Thank you so much, Dr. Seltzer, for a stellar presentation, full of information for our participants. I know that there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much again. And our next speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman, and Dr. Fleischman is former founding director, Cancer Support Services, Continuum Cancer Centers of New York, now part of the Mount Sinai Health System, author and researcher in oncology. And Dr. Fleischman will be discussing follow-up with your oncologist and primary care doctor, including discussion of health screening and concerns, as well as guidelines to prepare for telehealth/telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Fleischman.
Thank you, and thank you everybody for tuning in today. One of the main things that we want to keep track of as we finish our first or second or multiple courses of treatment, or even if we're on maintenance treatment, is who's going to be in charge? Is it going to be one of the oncologists, whether the surgical oncologist, the medical oncologist, or the radiation oncologist, or they are turning care over to your primary care doctor? The communication between those groups is essential. And in many places, because of an electronic health record, everybody can read each other's notes, and everybody can read all the tests that were ordered and reviewed by all the other providers. And then it's an easy transition. Primary care providers, and I've been working in primary care now for about 14 years after working in oncology for my whole career, it's a mixed bag, because as primary care doctors, we want to know what to do as far as vigilance, as far as the tests that need to be done, and we want our patients and families to know what they need to do during the period of survivorship and not to do. And some of this is sort of intuitive and very basic about proper activity levels, proper nutrition, all those sorts of things, not smoking, staying away from alcohol and other drugs. The list is way too long to be able to review here. But knowing what to do, what not to do, and what the providers need to do to check on you is important. One of the things that comes up repeatedly is, as other speakers mentioned, if you have a symptom or something happens and you're not sure about it. And as you've heard from the other speakers, just supposing that that's due to cancer right away causes a lot of worry and maybe needless worry. So one of the rules I have thought that was helpful all these years is, if it comes and goes, it's probably not the cancer. And if it comes and stays, it needs attention. And that attention should be brought to the provider who's in charge of your care. Care is very different now because of technology. And there's been a lot of discussion in the past few months about the use of artificial intelligence in medical care. Some good, some bad. One of the ways that artificial intelligence can help is by helping you formulate what questions you need to ask your providers. Artificial intelligence is not at a point yet where it knows exactly who you are, and it may be able to coalesce a lot of information that's available on the internet, but it doesn't know what applies to you, and it doesn't know what is best for you. It can be very useful in helping to make sure that you go into a follow-up visit with your providers with the questions that are really, really important to you and your situation at that point in or after your treatment. So having a list of questions is a good thing. Having somebody come with you or attend with you, whether if it's on an electronic or telehealth visit, is very helpful, because sometimes the situation is just complex and overwhelming, and it's kind of hard to really pay attention and be part of the conversation as well as write everything down at the same time. So having a friend or relative, someone you trust, who's a good scribe, who can take good notes, is very, very helpful. And that really opens up a whole new opportunity in telehealth, because it used to be that that friend or relative needed to travel with you to your visit, sometimes in another city, sometimes in another country. And now, as long as they have access to internet and they are, you know, they're invited into the call, it can be really, really helpful to have that occur electronically rather than in person. Telehealth calls are a whole new way of doing things in medicine. We've gotten used to them since the pandemic over the last few years, but it means that everybody has new responsibilities. The provider's office needs to make sure you know how to connect to them, and sometimes they may actually have you do a trial run before your actual visit. And you need to have a bunch of things. You need to have a device that you can use. You need to have that device charge so that the battery doesn't run out or plugged in. You need to have a good internet connection, usually by Wi-Fi or by a cell tower service, and a quiet place to be in, because background noises can really interfere with what you can hear and what your providers can hear. But it can be really, really helpful and save a whole lot of travel. So along with telehealth, one of the things that has really changed the way patients and providers interact is the ability to read parts of your chart and to see your test results either online. That can be very helpful, and it is also really challenging. Very often, you will see test results before your providers can take a look at it. And this is, there are many systems, but in general, this is something called open notes. If you see results, please be sure to ask your provider's office to help you interpret them. There are let's say in results for blood work, there are the findings, the levels of things that you have, be it your hemoglobin or your glucose level or your potassium level or many other things, and then there's usually a normal range. That normal range does not know that you're in the middle of treatment or just finished treatment, and it may not apply to you. Some of those tests should be abnormal during treatment or after treatment. So please don't take every abnormal as something terrible or something worrisome, but ask someone in your provider's office to review these with you, either on the phone, via a telehealth visit, or in person on your next visit. Same thing with pathology reports, imaging meaning the umbrella for x-rays, CAT scans, MRIs, PET CATs, and pathology reports can be extremely daunting to understand. Many people who do not work in oncology do not look at these reports with the same level of understanding, and it's important to have somebody help you interpret these and not jump to conclusions that just don't make sense. So lots of information in a short amount of time. Use AI to help you formulate your questions, not to diagnose or guide your treatment. And if you do telehealth, perhaps you can get someone to sign on who can help you keep track of all the information and help you with make sure that all your questions are answered. And please be aware that you need help in interpreting all of the information that's on an electronic record. With that, I turn the call over back to Joni.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fleischman, for just another wonderful presentation. Like you said, full of information, including tips and suggestions for our participants. So thank you so much again. And our next speaker is Sarah Tenenhouse. And Ms. Tenenhouse is an oncology social worker and support group program manager here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Tenenhouse will go over Cancer Care's free national programs and services, as well as our Hopeline and website. It is now my great pleasure to turn the program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Tenenhouse.
Thank you so much, Johnny. Okay, so Cancer Care is a national United States-based nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops like this one, publications, and some limited financial assistance. To connect with Cancer Care's services, those interested can call Cancer Care's National Hope Line to speak with an oncology social worker. And the number for that is 1-800-813-4673. Again, that's 1-800-813-4673. Cancer Care's resource navigation services are offered nationally to patients, post-treatment survivors, and caregivers affected by cancer. We offer a short-term, strengths-based approach to resource navigation where the social worker will work with the client to connect them with resources, referrals, and financial assistance. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board, and those are facilitated by professional oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and you can register on our website, that's cancercare, one word, .org, to join an online support group. Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, has a wide array of reading material and information related to post-treatment survivorship. This includes recorded a previous Connect education workshops, as well as Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast. And we have publications and resources geared towards supporting people who are in post-treatment survivorship. For any further assistance and to access any of our services, you can, again, call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673. Thank you so much, Johnny.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tenenhouse. Just an incredibly comprehensive presentation of all the resources that we offer here at Cancer Care. So thank you so much again. And now, we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay, so we have quite a few questions. Our first question is for Ms. Tenenhouse. Do you have any resources or recommendations on seeing an oncology social worker or someone to help me as a survivor?
Great question. So as one of our panelists mentioned, counseling is sometimes available post-treatment through your treatment center. So that is where I would suggest starting. But if you do not have access to counseling at your treatment center, a couple of resources where you may find a counselor who takes your health insurance. The website Psychology Today has a cancer therapist finder tool, and the easiest way to find that is probably with just doing an internet search. And then you can filter by your location and by your insurance in order to find a counselor who has cancer experience. The organization Cancer Support Community on their website is cancersupportcommunity.org,
has national chapters. They have various support services, and in some locations are affiliated with various other local programs. They may offer individual counseling as well. If you do need any support in finding a local resource, you can definitely call our Hope Line, and we can provide some individualized assistance in identifying resources. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you so much, Sarah. We have a question here for Dr. Ross. Is it common for cancer survivors to be so fearful of a recurrence that it is hard for them to try and go back to the way their life ways before cancer?
That's a very good question. So I always call cancer a life-changing experience because it changes our life by often disrupting the way that we used to live our life, but it also provides an opportunity for us to reevaluate our core personal values and really shine a light on what's most important to us and what matters the most, and then we change our priority list. So I don't know that we can ever go back to living life the way it exactly was before cancer. I think it's always going to be different because we've gone through this experience. We've hopefully grown through it, and we're able to accept whatever changes we have. I mean, sometimes, you know, patients have physical changes that happen to them because of their cancer surgeries, and we have to learn to adapt because we're remarkably resilient. So I think it's really about trying to deal with that uncertainty and trying to stay in touch with the things that matter most with you, because that will keep you grounded in the present moment so that you can keep rebuilding your life after cancer. Does that make sense?
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Ross. Another question is here for Dr. Shapira. How can we find free or cheap resources for survivorship issues like neuropathy, surgical menopause, cognitive issues, etc.? It's so expensive to try and afford all these.
I'm sorry, can you just repeat the question? How can we find what exactly?
Free or cheap resources for survivorship issues. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a brilliant question. I'm not quite sure where you're located, but it isn't easy, and there is no single answer that I can give you to help find these resources. I think this is where connecting with your local team and or with people who have gone through the experience may help. But there aren't that many qualified menopause practitioners who are sort of ready to treat cancer survivors. Same thing for neuropathy. So the things that you're bringing up are, spot on. These are the kinds of concerns that often accompany the survivor for a very long time, if not indefinitely. So I think my short answer is loop back to your clinical care team and see what they recommend from their experience of working with local specialists or community-based organizations.
Thank you so much for that answer, Dr. Shapira. I have a question here for Dr. Fleischman. What does open notes mean? And is it another or a new my chart?
Okay, so open notes is a general term for being able to access your information from one of your devices. My chart or Epic is only one brand of them. There are a number of different ones that are popular throughout the United States and different ones in other countries. But that's just sort of an umbrella term for being able to access your information electronically.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Fleischman. We had a question about if this will be available for replay. And yes, we will have this workshop up on our website in about a week to 2 weeks after today with the webcast and a recording of the workshop today. Right. And now I'm going to ask our speakers to provide their takeaways. We'll just do a minute or so takeaway. We'll start with Dr. Shapira, Dr. Ross, Dr. Seltzer, Dr. Fleischman, and then Ms. Tenenhouse. So Dr. Shapira?
Thank you. So survivorship lasts a long time, and the type of concerns and needs that people have varies. My advice and take home is think about and reflect on your experience and what you need, and try to find specialized help for what it is that you're concerned about and living with.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shapiro. And Dr. Ross?
Yeah, I echo what Dr. Shapiro says. I think it's a, you know, survivorship isn't just that when you ring the bell, it's all done and you go back to the way your life was beforehand. It's different, and you're continuing to heal and you're continuing to monitor, and you just learn to live life a little bit differently. But you can still live life, right? It's learning to live with cancer or having been through a cancer experience. So stay connected to those support services that can help you. Stay connected with your team, your medical team that's keeping an eye on you and watching with you. And stay connected to everything that matters in your life that's meaningful, the people, the things you like to do. Maybe you have to do them a little differently, but you can still do them.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ross. And Dr. Seltzer?
Yes, thank you again for the invitation to speak today. I just want to echo what Dr. Ross said. I mean, I have a lot of veterans who I support, or veterans with cancer who I support here at the VA, who express that cancer for them was a wake-up call, not just a wake-up call about their health, but about their lives and what they're doing with their lives. So I would encourage all survivors to meet the moment, to harness that feeling, to savor the moments in their lives, to maybe engage in something that you've always wanted to do and never had the ability to do or never had the motivation to do because of just the inertia of life. So while it can be shocking and stunning and upsetting all at the same time, cancer and cancer survivorship is also, for many people, an important opportunity to live their lives to the fullest and to engage in values-oriented behavior, as Dr. Ross alluded to. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Seltzer and Dr. Fleischman.
Yes, a lot of information will be coming to you and is coming to you. Some of that is from internet sources, maybe filtered through artificial intelligence, some of it from your own records and results. Please get help interpreting those so you get the right help for the right things and not jump to the wrong conclusion about things. And that way it saves a whole lot of worry and you can navigate this period of survivorship in a much better way.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fleischman. And Ms. Tenenhaus?
Yes, if you find that you need additional emotional support or counseling support, even if it's several years out, that's completely normal and a really common question that we get. And definitely do not hesitate to reach out to cancer care or to your treatment team about counseling or emotional support.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tenenhaus. And I just want to take this moment to conclude and thank all of our speakers. This panel has been phenomenal today. I also want to thank our participants. Today's program was particularly exceptional because of the questions that were asked on this call and the way that they were answered by our panel of experts today. I do want to say a few words about that, though. For those of you that didn't have your question answered, I would like you to go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your questions. Remember, you've learned a great deal from today's program, and I want you to take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask your question again. Even to those who did have their questions answered today, please go back to your healthcare team and ask them. And also, I want to remind everyone that it's very important to know who to contact on evenings, weekends, and holidays, because we do hear that oftentimes when things happen, people don't know who to reach out to during that time, so it is important to know now who to reach out to on evenings, weekends, and holidays. And I also just want to say, I don't want anyone to leave this workshop feeling as if they are alone. Please know that you are not alone. You have a community of support here at Cancer Care. All right, and I appreciate everyone's participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.